we've just completed 7 years. I'll be starting the 8th year of doing Dialogue Conspiracy. The very first broadcast I did, some of you have listened back that far, even remember. It became very much in the news that Daniel Ellsberg, as part of the Defense Department, the National Security Council, exposed the Pentagon Papers and how we got into the war in Vietnam. The New York Times started publishing those accounts, and they came out in a book. And then later, Richard Nixon wanted to prosecute Daniel Ellsberg for exposing the Vietnam escalation of the war and the way it came about. And I did a news analysis at the time in 1971 on the Pentagon Papers. I've been doing research since 1963, and I was asked about what I thought about this new headline that was taking the news. There hadn't been any expose of this kind. As far as I could recall, it caused so much of a commotion criticizing the government. It should have happened years ago after John Kennedy was killed with the cover-up there in the Warren Commission, but people didn't come forward and expose the Warren Commission. Just a handful of researchers did. So I gave an analysis of Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers, and the point I made was that after this expose cooled down, we would have other real stories. That the biggest story in the country was the killing of President John Kennedy, and then Malcolm X and Reverend Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, the leaders, the president and the senator that was to be president, and the two black civil rights leaders, the most eloquent speakers for the black people of the United States, were all gunned down. And I expressed the idea that, we should pursue exposés and encourage people like Daniel Ellsberg and find out who's behind these killings and who is behind the cover-up. So now it's years later, it's 7 years later, and I have in front of me an article from the United Press International, and this is a first. 7 years later, the headlines of the Salt Lake Tribune said, Oswald and FBI informer. Now, I haven't seen it in the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, the Washington Post, or any of the other papers that I take. I get 10 papers daily and clippings from around the country, but only the Salt Lake Tribune has carried this story, and yet it's a UPI story, and that is a landmark story because this is the first time, to my mind, in my collection of articles on the Kennedy assassination, that it's been told so bluntly. And the story says that a former FBI informer, an employee, said in a documentary film on French television that Lee Harvey Oswald, the presumed assassin of President Kennedy, was an informant for the Bureau. Now, this same person, Bill Walder, was written up in the L.A. Free Press article on the John Kennedy assassination, the one and only issue that was gotten out before Larry Flynt was shot. And they talked about this man that worked in the New Orleans office. But that didn't make the wire services. That was published in Los Angeles. It went out nationally. But it still wasn't carried, as far as I know, by the Associated Press or the United Press. But this French, the story from Paris that's carried on the UPI goes even further, because it talks about a member working in the FBI office in New Orleans and having advance information November 17, 1963, that John Kennedy's life was going to be wiped out, that they expected to kill him in Dallas November 22nd or 23rd. But the interesting thing about the French television and the UPI story is that they brought in another witness, Oreste Piña, and most of the people who do research on the political assassinations know that man very well. He worked with the anti-Castro Cubans and worked with the FBI, and he's a Cuban exile, and he also is an FBI informant. And Mr. Piña now has surfaced, and he told the film director that in New Orleans, he worked with Lee Harvey Oswald in the FBI, and he said, we went each morning to make our report, and afterwards we would go together for breakfast in the trade winds at a snack bar used by the FBI agents. Piña identified Warren DeBries as the FBI officer handling his and Lee Harvey Oswald's case. Piña said that shortly before he testified before the Warren Commission, Mr. DeBries said, I'll get rid of your ass if you mention Oswald's FBI links. Well, this is years later now. It's 1978, and he is surfacing and talking about Lee Harvey Oswald being in the FBI. Of course, people that have done research as long as I have, or even in the last up to the last 4 or 5 years, know the examples and the stories of Lee Harvey Oswald with agents of the FBI in New Orleans, Dallas, Mexico. But to carry it on a wire service just so many years later is a starting point in the awareness of American people. And maybe we'll begin to get the headlines that I talked about, where the truth really comes out about Lee Harvey Oswald being an agent for the United States government, for the Navy intelligence, and for the Defense Industry Security Command. Maybe all this work is not going down the drain. I'm sure that those people involved are getting encouragement by the various researchers who have published so many books, who are on the radio all the time, such as myself, writing articles about the assassinations. It must encourage them to come forward. And another thing that must be in their mind is that those that don't come forward are being murdered anyway, so they may as well tell the truth either way. I think they're safer by coming forward. Just this morning, I received a telephone call from a man who is a close associate of a man whose name I have from the Warren Commission hearings, a friend of Lee Harvey Oswald. And he called me from up in the Bay Area, and he wants to meet with me, and hopefully next week I'll see him. And he reminded me to open certain volumes of the Warren Commission hearings, which I had read and indexed and cross-filed over and over again. And they had reference to the positive proof that Lee Harvey Oswald was in Navy intelligence. I knew that by reading the Warren Commission documents. But this man served in the war in the Marines with Lee Harvey Oswald, and they were in intelligence. And I can meet him. He was a former policeman and had a public position in Salinas, California. The man that actually worked with Lee Harvey Oswald doesn't live too far from where I live, and the intermediary called me from the Bay Area. And he's ready now for press conferences and to come forward in the same manner that Mr. Pena is talking now and Mr. Walter. So the Daniel Ellsberg story fired off the imagination of Louis Tackwood, the agent provocateur for the Los Angeles Police Department, who said he was inspired to tell the truth about the criminal conspiracy section and what they were doing because of the courage of Daniel Ellsberg. And then there was Larry Shears, and then a whole group of various people, not enough of them, inside the working team began to tell little pieces. But this is an important story, so my predictions at the time of the Pentagon Papers are coming true now, and the news is being carried at least in some newspapers, and eventually it'll hit all the neighborhood stores and newspapers in the everyday press, although I'm really glad to see it in the Salt Lake Tribune. Last week I talked about the King Alfred plan, and I got a lot of response and calls and people asking what they could do, and some were scared and a little bit of disbelief. Those of you that didn't hear it last week can order the tape cassettes from me. I have them. There isn't a person living in Jacksonville, Florida, who has an organization called the King Alfred Research Project. And you can write to them. You can write to the King Alfred Research Project, P.O. Box 12305, Jacksonville, Florida, 32209. Or you can write to me again or call and get that information. But this party, his name is Capers Thompson, but you just write in charge of the King Alfred Research Project. He has a newsletter quarterly coming out. It's $3, and he has a fact sheet on Crime Bill 1437. That's the new crime bill that's gone through the Senate. They're trying to push through the House and through the House of Representatives, and information on cable splicer and the garden plot, the plans for military dictatorship taking over the government, and the links of the 1313 plan, the CIA Mormon use Nevada operations. And he has information on SWAT teams, and he defines certain letters that you may see in the news, like the FPA, the CNC, the CRP. And you can study what these organizations are. He says, what's behind the national ID system? Why was the CIA involved in LSD experiments? Who is a former Air Force general in charge of the Hughes Nevada operations? Is the Hughes Corporation a model after IG Farben? This comes out four times a year. You can write to the King Alfred Research Project and keep up on what he's trying to say. I think it's important to follow this and not take it lightly. There was a news dispatch. It came out in November 1977, and I don't know if many of you saw it. It was a quotation because of an interview in Penthouse of Mr. Brzezinski, the head of our National Security Council, appointed by President Carter. It's a quotation that was in Penthouse saying that Mr. Brzezinski believes that democracy itself is a threat to the smooth functioning of an American state, of a modern American state. He said, I think we accept social regulation. Therefore, we need legislation such as for a number of children, legislation determining the sex of children, the regulation of weather, and the regulation of leisure, and so forth. In 1973, Brzezinski organized and became the director of the Trilateral Commission, which Mr. Capel, Craig Capel, says is the pre-crisis management institution whose purpose is to identify in advance any likely social crisis and to develop some program to cope with them. Brzezinski works with President Carter very closely, formed the Trilateral, and feels, in quotes, that, put it lightly, the greatest danger to the American way of life comes from a democracy. He wants to centralize the economic and social planning, concentrate congressional powers in committees, make legislatures less responsive to the constituents, and, of course, limit the press. That is the founder of the Trilateral Commission. And again, we don't have to take him too lightly. I don't think we should. Several weeks ago, before I talked about the King Alfred Plan, I was talking about plans for future genocide and the movie Holocaust and the plans of the doctors and psychiatrists to continue the Holocaust in the United States. I believe that the plans are evident in my articles and clippings and books. Give me no reason to relax that they are not ready to institute the same things that happened in Nazi Germany. And of course, I've talked about Reinhard Gehlen, Hitler's chief of intelligence, who expressed the desire to turn 50 million people in the Ukraine into subhumans and 40 million to murder immediately by means of famine or another method, but famine would be the best. Now, Gehlen was brought to the United States by Alan Dulles. That's the same Alan Dulles that Richard Nixon writes about in his book, who wouldn't shake hands with Chu En Lao. He wouldn't express, in 1954, a greeting of friendship, just gentleman to gentleman. But by 1954, he had brought the top Nazis out of Germany, hundreds and hundreds of them, and hundreds of millions of dollars, to continue their expertise around the world. It was Alan Dulles who brought Reinhard Gehlen to this country and then gave him $200 million of our tax dollars. That's the same man, even though he knew that Reinhard Gehlen had the plans for starving, as he says, 40 million immediately in the Soviet Union when they went there, and making 50 million agricultural slaves. That's the kind of gentleman that Dulles would shake hands with and dine with and give $200 million of our tax dollars. Now, I worry about those Nazis. I continuously talk about them, and I gave a list several weeks ago of the top institutions that are dangerous in this country. But the top priority, I think, of all the institutions that's the most secretive, the most dangerous, and I will run down some of the others on various programs, is the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. It's made up of people, a handful of scientists that are never on the premise. Howard Hughes wasn't a scientist himself. The Institute is nothing at the minimum but a huge tax rip-off where millions, hundreds of millions of dollars should have gone back to the Treasury for the people to use, but they're using it to fund congressmen and pay off police chiefs and district attorneys and attorney generals and FBI chiefs and buy the, like Howard Hughes said, buy the Supreme Court justices on down. This money goes to buy public officials. There's no control of this institution. It's a private institution, no accounting to the people. The money should be going into the Treasury, and it should be broken apart and smashed open. It's only a building, and the campus at the University of Miami, and it should be torn apart. There's a strong liaison between the Rockefeller Medical Institute that we'll go into someday and the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. But if there was no Howard Hughes after 1957, if he was never seen after 57, if he was simply a cover for the CIA and the Defense Department and for various assassination teams, then the same secrecy that was used through from World War I to World War II could be behind the facade of the Medical Institute. I brought to share with you some memos that came out of the Howard Hughes Empire that were down in Mexico when the police confiscated them that described the Medical Institute. And I think it has to be watched because of the way they describe it and the way they talk about the plans to use engineers similar to Nazi Germany. There's one memo that was brought to me by Douglas Wallace. You remember, he was on Dialogue Conspiracy last March. And it says, the medical business is the fourth largest and fastest growing industry in the nation at a turning point. The traditional practice of medicine, where each doctor becomes an entrepreneur, has proven to be too costly. You don't want your private doctors. Therefore, a management team has organized a successful biomedical research corporation 4 years ago and has been identified, consisting of professional managers and doctors and scientists in the Salt Lake area who are desirous to working with us on this project. They are currently affiliated with the University of Utah and recognized nationally for their work in technology and medicine. They are supported by government contracts, and their prime contract expires in May of this year. That was 74. The physicians are experienced medical practitioners, having pioneered in the introduction of heart surgery. The scientists are experienced in the application of engineering to the solution of medical problems. The managers have an accumulated experience of 21 years managing the high technology development programs. There are 3 MDs, 6 PhDs, 2 experienced managers. The initial clinics would be operated in Salt Lake because the medical climate is known and favorable. Nationally respected local doctors are part of our effort. Of course, they were national, international famous doctors in Germany that were behind the experimentation. But the theme of this memo is that the individual doctor is not practical anymore. He becomes an entrepreneur that is too costly to have a man go out house to house and take care of individual needs. That a management has to be affiliated with government contracts that are experienced to apply engineering to the solution of medical problems. I have those 4 books, The Doctors of Death, I told you about Auschwitz and how it was formed. And these sentences come directly out of the kind of mentality that Galen brought to this country through these people. The managers have accumulated experience of 21 years. So that means from 1974, they were saying this, from 1954 to 1974, in the management of high technology programs, and engineers would be brought in to handle the problem of medicine as against the family doctor. There was a long article on the Hughes Medical Institute in April 1976, just 2 years ago. It was published by the Knight Combine, which is similar to the Hearst, large corporation for newspaper dissemination. And just the week that this came out, the Knight heir, one of the young men, was just killed in a murder which appeared to be a homosexual type of murder, but was very mysterious. And it came out at the time that the newspaper was breaking this story. But the description of the Medical Institute, the best description, comes from the doctors themselves involved. And I want to read a little of this to you with a few of my comments. The article comes from the Miami Herald, but was carried also in the Chronicle back in April of 76. These are, quote, some congressmen called a tax shelter, which has nothing to do with mankind. The Miami connection for the Howard Hughes Medical Institute began 20 years ago when Kenneth Wright was asked to run the Hughes Medical Center because he was a good man and a friendly doorman. He was studying business at the University of Miami, and he became a doorman. And it reminds me that one of the 2 nurses that took care of Howard Hughes was a doorman. They picked him up. He was a bouncer in London, a muscle man. And when Howard Hughes, or that body, was cashed in of April of 76, it was nothing but a bleeding corpse with all kinds of problems, allowed to die. The bouncer at Auschwitz or Buchenwald is the man who guards the door. He doesn't need any expertise except that nobody gets through the door to know what's going on. So the man who runs the Hughes Medical Institute is Kenneth Wright, who was a chauffeur and a doorman and asked to run the institute. The institute is at 1550 Northwest 10th Street on the campus of the University of Miami, but it has very little to do with the people at the university because it works behind closed doors and drawn drapes. The University of Miami lends it an academic cover, but they don't use the students from the University of Miami. Men and women at this institute, according to the Miami Herald, are secretive, suspicious, defensive about scrutiny, or even to inquire into what they are doing. This is from the Miami Herald. Now, the used aircraft receives $1.5 million every 24 hours. The profits from the weapons, we are charged for our tax money to put up money for these weapons from the used aircraft. They make a profit at it. They take all that profit and they turn used aircraft over completely to the medical institute. There's no accounting or inspection by the Internal Revenue Service. This institute was started the year before Howard Hughes went into total seclusion, and Richard Nixon gave the approval for the IRS to make it a tax-deductible shelter. That was the year of the famous Nixon burger, when Nixon's brother got $200,000 from Howard Hughes. The Miami Herald says their obsession for secrecy borders on absurdity. This is quoting Dr. Robert Busek, B-O-U-C-E-K. For 15 years, he's worked at the Hughes Medical Research Center. He says it's self-defeating, unfathomable, except that is the way the old man wanted it. The excuse for Nuremberg was we were only taking orders. The Miami Institute, the Hughes Medical Institute, can be secretive, obnoxious, unfathomable, self-defeating, suspicious, defensive, beyond scrutiny. The excuse is that Howard Hughes, this dead man, told them to be that way, or Howard Hughes, who had no communication with the world, told them to be that way, and we're only doing what he wanted. It's not even a living general or somebody they're taking orders from, but it's 1976, they're writing, this man's dead, and the scrutiny is the way he wanted it. As what's Angleton said, there's a quotation, James Angleton, the CIA, he says, Hughes was a wonderful person, a wonderful buddy. When we needed him, he was there. He said, in effect, that we couldn't have managed without Howard Hughes. The Miami Herald said the Hughes Institute dispenses $1 million a year to 40 researchers or investigators with outstanding credentials. These individual grants are very small but prestigious. And once they get those from us, then they get funding from other sources. The Hughes Medical Institute gets them started. Then they get money from the CIA, Rockefeller Medical Institute, Stanford Institute, UCLA, CIA, or George Washington University. They get these people trained down there for whatever they're doing, and then they put them out in universities or other places, and they get government grants. The researchers are paid directly by the Hughes Institute. It is confusing about the mystery, the newspaper said, on who gets what and how much money they get. Even on the Miami campus, very few know the details of the Howard Hughes researchers. Dr. Emanuel Papper, the University of Miami Vice President, Dean of Miami Medical School, said, it is such a confidential empire, the Hughes Medical Institute has given more than $6 million to the Miami researchers since it started in 1956. But they will not tell you what doctors are involved, what they're doing, or where that money is going. They have a budget that includes money, $150,000 for their staff, the rent $60,000 a year. The researchers receive $200,000 to $300,000 a year. Dr. William Harrington, Dean of the Miami School of Medicine, said that used money serves two key departments. One is medicine and the other is biochemistry. The Miami Herald goes on and says, why did this native Texan, Howard Hughes, who never had a permanent home, never attended a medical school or was interested in medicine, set up his headquarters in this part of the world, in Florida? It's equally curious why the aviation engineer, movie producer, corporation manipulator, a man who made enormous demands on people, decided to turn to this basic laboratory of research. Could the same man who discovered Jean Harlow and Jane Russell, who owned 7 Las Vegas casinos, be interested in immune adherence and viral bacteria? Yes, he could. As a matter of fact, he could. He's also interested, whoever's doing it, in genetic research. Good questions, again, said Dr. Buick, but don't bother asking them at the Institute, because Kenneth Wright, the doorman who's now the director, doesn't talk. He doesn't give interviews. Leroy Collins, the former governor of Florida, said it was in the spring of 1956. Howard Hughes envisioned a medical city. The man who was called the spook of American capitalism described how he meant to have a medical school And he would pay people to handsomely make them so comfortable they wouldn't want to leave the Paradise Island. He was prepared to spend $400 million, and one day the medical center would be the repository of his estate. Now, I remember when the UCLA school at CIA, Dr. West, wanted a special note. It was a night base from the military to put electrode implants into prisoners that would be isolated on this base. And I'm wondering, all of a sudden, in 1956, Howard Hughes is going to put in this multi-million-dollar medical island and laboratory for experimentation and make people so happy they'll never leave that Emerald Island. It describes the Emerald Island. And fund them with hundreds of thousands of dollars, and goodness knows what they were planning to do. The Miami Herald says that while Hughes abandoned his idea for an island city, the corporate wheels spun around, and through a series of complicated, unorthodox maneuvers, starting in December 53, he split off the Hughes aircraft from the Hughes Tool Company and gave the entire aircraft with its government contracts and created the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. Non-stock, non-for-profit corporation, a single trust under the name of Howard Hughes. Now, this gets a little scary when you realize that that man was zonked and drugged and kept incommunicado since 1957. There was another article in the Salt Lake Tribune this last week. Jean Peters, the alleged wife of Howard Hughes, testified at the trial of the Mormon will that she went back to Boston in 1966 and saw Howard at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel and never saw Howard Hughes again after 1966. Now, I've alleged for a long time that I don't believe Howard Hughes was seen again except by a few people on a Greek island after 1966, that he wasn't in Las Vegas. And a lot of people didn't believe my account that Jean Peters was his wife and she used to visit him on the weekends and she used to come to Las Vegas. But when it comes down to the push and shove, she testified under oath that she never saw that person who left the Ritz-Carlton Hotel after or before his medical treatment in Boston. She never saw him again, and the doctors who treated him in Boston were brought up from the Hughes Medical Institute. The Medical Institute has been charged of being a tax ripoff, where they make millions of dollars off of contracts, $60 million at a time, the Hughes aircraft. They pour it into there. They're not using that amount for the research that they're supposed to be using it. Chairman Wright Patman of Texas wanted to investigate from 1954 to 61 how the Howard Hughes Institute spent $57 million for research, $5.7 million for research, and yet they were earning $76.9 million in profits. They weren't using it for medical research, and yet documents came out that they were giving it to congressmen such as Gerald Ford and many other men that were on the Warren Commission, covering up like Gerald Ford and a long list of congressmen. Millions of dollars were earned by Hughes aircraft, and a fraction went to the Medical Institute. Of course, Representative Wright Patman died shortly after he began to consider this investigation. I think the Hughes Medical Institute is a dangerous one. I think it's patterned after Dachau and Auschwitz. I think it should be broken open. I think they should stop sending the profits of Hughes Air Company to it. If you want to get the Miami Herald through your library, April 25th, 1976, there's a long article that I don't have time to go into. But through my research, I believe, looking at the staff of who's on it, what they're doing, how their secrecy works, who runs it, and how it was organized, I believe it's a front for genocide and for viral and genetic research and for medical things that will harm us in the end. I don't think it's going to help us, and I think medicine should be put back in the private doctors and not into engineering programs. Well, I don't have time to do all of the Hughes Medical. We'll go into some of the other medical institutions that I fear in the weeks to come, but in the meantime, our time is up, so you have a nice May. I like May days. They're warm and sunny. I hope you're enjoying your month of May, and we're getting into it. Have a good time. I'll see you next week on Dialogue Conspiracy.
You've been listening to Dialogue Conspiracy with Mae Brussel.